25 years ago, almost the day, I found myself on the Somme looking down at my great uncle's headstone in a cemetery called Bousincourt Communal Cemetery Extension. And later on that day, I was standing at the place near Poitiers where he was mortally wounded on the evening before his death. And as I've said many times to people and on this podcast, it was a moment in time that changed my life. I decided at that moment that not only did I need to find out more about my great uncle Henry, I wanted to do the same for other people. This was going to be my retirement hobby. And slowly and surely, over the next 25 years, it has become my retirement hobby. Although it was to take another 20 years of work before I was able to retire. And as you know, apart from doing these podcasts, I get immense satisfaction out of researching the soldiers' stories from the Great War and then sometimes taking their ancestors on a journey following in their footsteps. And that's exactly what we're going to do this week in the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. Because once again, last week, we headed for France with 9 people and 5 of them had stories of soldiers that served and some of them died in the Great War. 2 of them were taken prisoner and we were following their story. The people wanted to stand where they stood. They wanted to go where they were captured and in some cases where they died. So that's what we did. We got a minibus. We went over to France on the Eurotunnel. And we did a loop, really, from Calais. We headed down the coast past Etaples with its 10,000 burials and its famous training ground. And we went to a beautiful place called Saint-Valery-sur-Somme. Saint-Valery-on-the-Somme. It's where the famous Somme River flows into the English Channel. One of our passengers, his grandfather, had served there. What was his story? And then from there we made our way down to our billet on the Somme. And then the next day we travelled east, beyond the 1916 Somme battlefields. And we found ourselves on the location where the Germans on the 21st of March 1918 launched their enormous spring offensive, the Kaiser's Battle. 2 of my friends had relatives that were captured amongst 21,000 others on that spring day. We'd learned their story and stood where they stood, terrified as they were captured. We then made our way on to the 1916 Somme battlefields and we went to a location not far from where I recorded a podcast a couple of weeks ago between High Wood and the village of Martinpuich. This was the scene on the 15th of September 1916, when famously the tanks went into action, but so did the infantry. And another of my friends lost a great uncle on this momentous day. He has no known grave. But did we find a final resting place for him? Find out today. And our last story was on the way back on the last day. We stopped at the Loos battlefield, the Loos Memorial to the Missing, to find another soldier that died in the Great War on the first day of the Battle of Loos and also has no known grave. What's his story? And what's the story of the cufflinks? Cufflinks owned by Bill, who was also touring with us on our minibus. How did Bill become the owner of the cufflinks that were once owned by a captain in the Welsh Regiment, a captain who has a connection with the British royal family, Queen Mother, her brother that also died at Loos? What's the connection there? Well, we'll find out. But before we do that, you know that I like coincidences. There's too many of these unusual occurrences that happen on the battlefields without there, in my opinion, being something more to it. Is it the soldiers presence that we can feel in our spirits that make these occurrences happen. Well, I've had quite a few lately, but there was one of them that really did stop me in my tracks. A few weeks ago, the Northampton Saints rugby club official historian, Graham McKechnie, who works for Radio Northampton, told me about a man called Fred Wright, who was originally from Northampton, but had emigrated to Australia before the Great War and joined up with the Australian Imperial Force. And like many others, he died at Moke Farm in August of 1916. Moke Farm is a location that we visited in the podcast a few weeks ago, but at that stage I didn't know this story. And then a couple of weeks back, when I then went to Moke Farm, I took a picture of Fred with me, and I stood there outside Moke Farm and thought of him. And his body wasn't recovered until 1936, 20 years after he died, and the Commonwealth War Graves Commission burial return made it possible, using the map coordinates, to locate exactly where he died and where his body was found. And then, because there were so few cemeteries still open in 1936 on the Somme, he was taken quite away. He was taken up to Sayre Road number 2, where he's now buried. So on that tour, as we were leaving the Somme, we went up to Sayre Road number 2 and paid my respects to Fred, and left a laminate with a photograph of him there and a summary of his service that I found in the local newspaper. So imagine my shock and surprise when, just a few days later, I received an email from a man called Steve Burnett, who comes from Adelaide in Australia. And it turns out that Fred Wright was a distant relation to him. And he decided, whilst on a battlefield tour to Europe, that he would go and visit Fred Wright's grave in Sayre Road number 2. And as far as we know, he was the first family member to ever visit the grave. And he sent an email to me telling me this. I'd left my contact details on the laminate. And he says, to his surprise, you'd left a wonderful write-up regarding Fred. Fred was great-uncle to my uncle Rodney in Adelaide, and Rod was married to my auntie Barbara, who was married to my mother's sister. And Rod's daughter, Christine, asked if we could drop by and pay our respects to Fred while we were in the area. Fred was originally in the 10th Battalion, he tells us. And there was another relative of Steve's that served in the same battalion but was killed during the Battle of Fromelles, and he's now buried at Pheasant Wood. So the story of Fred, which Steve and his family were not fully aware of, has now gone back to Adelaide. What a coincidence that was. There's over 7,000 burials in Sayre Road No. 2 Cemetery. It's the biggest cemetery on the Somme. So many of them there are unknown. I think it's over 70%. How can it be that Fred Wright gets a visit from me when a week earlier I didn't even know he existed? He played a few times for Northampton Saints, hence Graham McKechnie's interest in him. His name is on the war memorial at Franklin's Gardens, Northampton Saints' home ground. And then just a few days later, for the first time possibly ever, a member of his family comes by and sees details of the relative that they couldn't possibly have known. It really does feel, again, that the Somme battlefield in particular is calling out and wants people to know its stories. But that can't be the same for the next story that I want to tell you. The first one on our pilgrimage last week. Somehow it felt that the man in question didn't want us to know what had happened, although he'd got nothing to be ashamed of. So this was a young man who was a driver in the Army Service Corps, Colin Pike, and he was attached to the 47th Auxiliary Ambulance Car. And we can see from his attestation form that when he was conscripted in 1916, he'd been working as a motor driver. There weren't many of those around in those days. And at the age of 19, He was placed in the Army Service Corps because those skills would be useful somewhere along the line on the Western Front. And after he carried out his training, he was on the Western Front for 3.5 years, between October 1916 until he was discharged, not immediately after the armistice. He was out on the Western Front, as we shall see, dealing with the casualties until March of 1920, well over a year after the armistice. Now, he joined the 47th Auxiliary Car Company in December 1916, and his job was to drive motor vehicles that had been converted into ambulances from the railway station in Aberfeyle to the various hospitals that were based in the town, and also to some of the casualty clearing stations that were further afield. And when we looked at his service record, as usual with soldiers, we found that there was a couple of misconduct charges. And this was the story of Colin Pike, really. So what was the role? We'll come to that in a minute. But what was the role of this auxiliary ambulance car company? Well, it was established towards the end of the Battle of the Somme, in and around Aberfeyle. And at first they had 25 ambulances. They were supposed to have 50. And the unit was under the command of a Captain E.E. Craig. And on the 4th of December 1916, two Daimler lorries were received for these transport duties. And there were also cars in the pool that were used for local duty, 7 of them. But we know that Colin was involved in driving these Daimler lorries. So up until April 1917, which was the start of the Battle of Arras, it had been practice to remove only a few of the serious cases from ambulance stations passing through Aberfeyle. But from this time onwards, complete trains were unloaded by the units at this local station. The first of them came from the Arras battlefield 2 days after the beginning of that battle. On the 11th of April, there were 300 of them, and they were sent to local hospitals outside the town. The work was done throughout the night in a heavy snowstorm, and no doubt Colin was involved in that. And then owing to the extension of the medical facilities in the Aberfeyle area, it was necessary in September of 1917 to send more vehicles, and cars were allocated further afield at places like Bermicourt and Fionnevillers, would play a part in Colin's story. And this meant that the number of ambulances was now raised to 17. And they also had some buses, 5 of them, that were being used as well. And then we get round to the German spring offensive in March 1918. And owing to the number of casualties arriving at the railhead at Amiens and the congestion on the railways, it was necessary to evacuate the patients by road to Aberfeyle. And Colin's unit was called on to assist in this work. And just after 3 days into that spring offensive, German spring offensive, on the 24th of March, 30 ambulances made a double journey. And on the following day, 40 vehicles were also used on this double journey, picking people up at Amiens, taking them to hospitals and casualty clearing stations, and then going back to pick up some more. And whilst this was happening in Amiens between 9 and 10 o'clock on the 24th, these patients may have thought that they were safe out of the line, but there was a hostile air raid took place. But fortunately, there were no casualties sustained by the unit. And during 3 days, 1,107 wounded soldiers were carried from Amiens to Aberfeyle, where they were taken to one of the base hospitals or stationary hospitals there. Even more so as that retreat by the British continued between the 22nd and the 30th of March, they carried 9,243 cases. And just shows how successful the evacuation process operated in dealing with these wounded soldiers, because although each of the casualty clearing stations and base hospitals, Commonwealth War Graves cemeteries attached to them, there's not that many soldiers that are buried in them, and that tells us that, by my calculations, 90% of these men survived the journey and went back to the UK for further treatment. And we visited Aberfeyle that railway station. It was built in 1912. We had a photograph of it during the war, which I'll put on the Terry's Tours website, on the podcast page. And in that photograph, we can see the casualties being loaded onto vehicles, just as we've described here. When we visited the modern station, it looked exactly the same as it did in 1917. So what was Collins' offences? How did he get himself into trouble? Well, as I said, we went to St. Valery. This was where some of the wounded soldiers were put onto hospital ships and returned to the UK, so no doubt Colin was involved in moving them to the port there. And it's a beautiful place now. In the estuary there, we could see boats bobbing around on the water. We went to a railway crossing, and this is where, on the 12th of November 1917, we don't know the full details, I'm just looking at the charge sheet now, and it says that Colin was ordered to pay £1.12.08 towards the cost of damage, and he was charged with conduct to the prejudicing of great order of the military discipline and neglecting to comply with an order, thereby causing damage to his vehicle. He'd crashed it on a level crossing, the level crossing that I took his grandson there to see. And he stood on that level crossing. It's still there at St. Valery. But this was our first stop on the tour. And as our minibus pulled up and we worked out exactly where we needed to be, the heavens opened, not just with rain and wind and hailstones. And we got out of the vehicle. We looked at each other and it somehow felt that he didn't want us to be there. He didn't want us to know this story. This incident occurred at 11:30 at night. What had he done? Was he on duty? Was it just an unfortunate accident? Or was he using the vehicle, perhaps to visit an estaminet when he was on his way home? Who knows? We don't know. I'm only speculating. Well, we do know that he's got another charge. And off we went to locate that level crossing. It's another railway crossing. And this incident occurred on the 30th of December 1918, so a few weeks after the armistice, but they're still wounded, he's still ferrying them around, and this time he's forfeited 3 days' pay. And it says that he halted the vehicle, he stalled it on a railway crossing, and this was at Fionnville. This was the location, probably about 20 miles away from Abbeville, and that's where there was a casualty clearing station, and we found that railway crossing again. And this time, having been bright sunshine on the 40-minute journey that it took us to go down from St. Valery, the heavens opened again. More rain, more sleet. There was some snow mixed in with that. And hailstones. And it was torrential. It went black. And again, it was so bad this time, we couldn't even get out of the vehicle. We just paused and thought of Colin, Nick's grandfather, and wondered what had happened that day. Just bad luck, I think. Nothing sinister. These vehicles were unreliable. And we know this happened because he's actually named in the unit diary. It says that the vehicle in the accident at St. Valery was badly damaged. And then it gives us the time that it happened, 11:30 p.m. Nick stood on that railway crossing at St. Valery after the hailstones had stopped. And he thought about his grandfather, but it was a grandfather he didn't know. In 1939, Colin, I found him on the register. He was living with his wife Elsie in Reading in Berkshire, but he died 10 years later, age 53. So Nick never knew his grandfather, and none of the family knew this story until I found it in the archives. So after a good night's sleep the next day, we headed to the scene of the German spring offensive that began on the 21st of March 1918 with the use of stormtroopers. If you remember the story, the Germans had transferred about 1 million men over from the Russian front, and this was their final chance really to win the war before the Americans arrived. And they very nearly did. They broke through the British lines, and eventually, after a few weeks of fighting, they ran out of steam, they ran out of supplies. They got ahead of their supply line and the morale was knocked. And their morale suffered blows when they realised that, despite being told the British, the Allies, were struggling for supplies, they found stores full of food, supplies, alcohol. But that's a story for another day. In amongst all this was a man called Private William Butlin. Although he was from Northampton, he was serving with the 9th Battalion of the Cheshire Regiment. And a few days into that battle, his battalion had been forced back just east of Bapaume, and they were fighting the Germans where there is now a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery called Delsall Farm Cemetery. Now, as usual, not sure that I've pronounced that right. The spelling is D-E-L-S-A-U-X Farm Cemetery, and it's close to a village called Bugney, B-E-U-G-N-Y. And it was here on the 24th of March 1918 that the battalion was subject to heavy German artillery fire. They were also attacked from the air. They were in trenches that they'd only managed to dig the day before. And the battalion diary goes on to tell us that on the 24th of March, during the early hours of the morning, our right company, which was at the farm itself and somewhat in advance of the general line, had formed a defensive flank to the 9th Welsh. And our artillery carried out a counter preparations at 5 and 6:15 a.m. because they'd been warned the day before that a German attack was on the way, and a withdrawal was expected by the battalion. But at 9 a.m., the Germans put down a very heavy barrage on the battalion front, and that lasted until 10:45 a.m., so nearly 2 hours, when an attack, it says, was delivered in mass. The battalion was forced out of part of the frontline trenches, but companies quickly reorganised in the support lines and delivered a counterattack, which was delivered by two captains and splendidly carried out, resulting in the taking of all of the lost trenches and inflicting heavy casualties on the enemy. It was also found that the enemy had suffered heavy casualties during his own attack from our rifle, Lewis gun and machine gun fire. But at 12 noon, orders were received for our withdrawal, and withdraw they did, leaving behind their dead and wounded. There was probably no time to take all of the wounded with them, or maybe William was captured by the Germans during that counterattack. We don't know for certain, but we do know during that week that 75 men of the 9th Cheshires died, and 18 of them are buried in that cemetery near Bapaume. But William, along with a Private D. Piggott, was taken to a German field hospital in Cambrai. This was a cemetery that was made by the Germans initially during their occupation. And it was in August of 1918 that the British took Cambrai, finally, and the Bavarian commandant handed over to the city the care and maintenance of the cemetery. The cemetery now contains 501 Commonwealth burials and memorials of the First World War, and they're buried in amongst hundreds of Germans. And they're now buried in this cemetery, and the cemetery is maintained by the VDK, the German equivalent of our Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And it was there, 3 days after being captured, that William Butlin died at the age of 31. He'd married his wife Emma on Christmas Day in 1911. And it's doubtful, of course, whether Emma ever had the opportunity to come here to pay her respects. But William's great-nephew, Martin, was with us. I'd researched the story for him many years ago, and I'd visited the grave twice before. But this was his first and probably only opportunity to represent the family. We gathered around, I told his story, and then Martin wanted to say a few words as he laid a small wooden cross with a poppy on it at the base of that headstone. The words chosen, family inscription, said, "The Lord said, retire." Martin noticed those words, and as he spoke, he became extremely emotional. because he realised that the day we were there, it was exactly 8 years to the day and almost to the very hour that his own mother had died. And the man whose grave we were looking down on was his mother's brother, William. And not only that, the week before, Martin had been to see William and his mother's sister, the last remaining sibling, and he told her the story of her brother, and he said that he was going off to find his grave and would return afterwards to tell her what he'd discovered. But sadly, just before Martin made the journey, she died. And Martin told us this as we stood there looking down at William's grave, and you can only imagine and appreciate his feelings as he did so. After the war, Emma married again, but I'm sure she never forgot William. Neither will Martin, neither will I, and hopefully neither will you now. Our journey then took us about 30 miles to the south, near the town of St. Quintin, but still within the battlefield of the 21st of March 1918, and this time we were following a man called Private 67175 Peter Lowe, serving with the 96th Field Ambulance in the Royal Army Medical Corps. And it was his relative, Sue, that was interested in this man. He'd got married to a lady called Evelyn in Prescott in Merseyside in 1898, and in 1911 on the census he was 33 years old and working in the local coal mine. And at that stage the couple had got 8 children. He enlisted in the Royal Army Medical Corps in August 1915 when he was 38, but sadly we find from his service record that one of those children, Norman, who was a baby, had died. I found his death certificate. It says that he died on the 1st of December 1915, and this is 4 months after Peter had joined the army. He was 12 months old when he died. Not unusual for children to die as early stages of their life in those days, but still a tragedy. And closer examination on his enlistment forms tells us that Peter arrived in France on the 9th of November 1915, and that was 3 weeks before Norman died. So he couldn't have been at home to comfort his wife and family. He was captured on the 21st of March 1918. He was in captivity for 9 months before he returned to the UK on the 18th of December 1918, a month after the armistice. And he was held at a German prisoner of war camp at Cassel. Now, before we go any further, I should say that a field ambulance in World War I terms is not a vehicle. It was a mobile frontline medical unit that was manned by troops from the Royal Army Medical Corps. And the idea was it was responsible for establishing and operating a number of points along the casualty evacuation chain. And it would also provide a walk-in wounded collecting station. So after being treated at a regimental aid post in the support or reserve trenches, the casualty would go back to a field ambulance and then from there to a casualty clearing station in the base, field and general hospitals on the coast. That's how it worked. And that's what Peter was doing on that day. They're in a quarry just behind the front line. And their unit diary tells us that just north of the village of Rupi, the Germans had managed to infiltrate the British defences. They'd surrounded them and they'd surrounded the quarry. And the diary says all personnel in the quarry were taken prisoner. And that would have included Peter. And there's no sign of that quarry now. I looked up and down the road, the main road where it was supposed to be. Couldn't see any sign of it at all on the modern maps, but it was definitely there. There's plenty of mentions of it in the records. So I took Sue to a field that overlooked that road, heading down towards St. Quintin from the village of Rupi. It's all quiet now. Absolutely no evidence whatsoever that anything ever happened there. But we know from the records that it did, that her relative Peter was captured there. And Peter died in 1944 at the age of 67 years old. We then got back on the minibus. We headed back to the 1916 Somme battlefields, and I found myself standing in a position where I was just a couple of weeks ago when I, as I mentioned earlier, recorded the podcast about Martin Puic. And it was the same day that this story is about. And this time it's a man from the northeast called William Gattons. And William was serving with the 1st 4th Battalion of the Northumberland Fusiliers when he was killed in action. On the 13th of September 1916, the battalion moved from the recently captured Mametz Wood for an attack to the left, as we look at it, of High Wood. And we could see from my linesman electronic trench map device that their starting positions were in Clark's Trench. They moved across no man's land and they managed to take Hook Trench without much opposition. The second objective was Starfish Lane. And as they moved across from Hook Trench to Starfish Lane, they were led by a corporal because all the officers in one company had been hit. As they moved across that field, the Germans at this stage were still holding High Wood, or what was left of it. They'd got their machine guns there, and they were firing across at the Northumberland Fusiliers, enfilade fire. By the end of the day, the battalion had suffered 499 casualties, killed, wounded or missing. William was one of those. And we stood on the corner of High Wood, just a few yards away from the London Cemetery, looked out across those fields and wondered whether William was still there. In a battalion diary, it tells us that at 11:30 a.m, heavy British artillery bombarded the northwest corner of High Wood, and the 47th Division, the Londoners, gradually worked their way around High Wood, and the enemy commenced retiring and were caught again by our machine gun fire, with 100 Germans caught by this fire, and they surrendered and High Wood was cleared step by step. News of our frontal attack on our second and third objectives came in slowly, only disconnected statements from wounded men for some time being received. At 3:30 p.m, Colonel Gibson moved his headquarters forward to Hook Trench. This was badly knocked about. Men of the 4th, 5th and a few of the 7th Northumberland Fusiliers were found muddled up here. Gibson then organised a whole of his objective, getting all these battalions together and establishing connection on the extreme right with the battalion of the 47th Division. At this period, there are 100 men of the 7th Northumberland Fusiliers in front of Hook Trench. All men of the brigade further forward had become casualties, except a handful who withdrew with 2nd Lieutenant Brown about 1:30 a.m. on the 16th. This was the situation at dusk. Total casualties, 17 officers. The battalion had gone into action with 22 officers and 695 other ranks. Casualties, 17 of those 22 officers. Other ranks, 110 killed, 229 wounded and 143 missing. These are the sort of casualties we were talking about a few weeks earlier on the 1st of July. Battalion was congratulated, it says, in very flattering terms by the senior officers of the brigade and division for their conduct on the 15th. And while we were there, I read this personal account of what it was like from a Sergeant Harold Horn, who was serving with the Northumberland Fusiliers that day. He said the hour before zero, while crouching in the trench and looking at one's watch, was an almost unbearable strain. Eventually, we heard the hum of machinery coming up behind us and saw through the mist great toad-like things with caterpillar tracks, a gun projecting forward and at the back a tail with two small wheels, and it came lumbering over the shell-holed ground at walking pace. One tank followed the tape to the filled-in place in the trench where I was and went on towards the German line. A few moments later, it was our zero time and we got out of the trench and followed. Once in the open and going forward, the tension and fear lessened to some extent, and a feeling of excitement took over, helped in this case, I suppose, by curiosity about the tanks. It was eventually established that 193 men died on that day from the battalion, and 158 of them, like William, are still missing and are remembered on the Tietvall Memorial. But 14 of them that were recovered are buried in the Delville Woods Cemetery, which is about a mile away. And that was to be our next destination. If we could find a plot with those 14 known burials in, perhaps there would be other Northumberland Fusiliers that are unidentified but are buried amongst them. And perhaps one of those could be William. The chances are that it wouldn't be, but it could be. And we became detectives. And we soon found those 14 men in two plots, plot 19 and 20, in that beautiful cemetery. And yes, in amongst them, there were dozens of unidentified Northumberland Fusiliers who, when their bodies were found, they couldn't identify who they were, but from some of the insignia, perhaps a cap badge, they knew they were Northumberland Fusiliers. They knew they'd died on that day. And Monica, whose relative it was, she found one of those. She chose one of those. And she adopted that grave, I suppose. That's the right way of putting it. And she stood there and thought about the man, William Gattons. She placed a small wooden cross there. She wrote his details on. And then we moved on a few miles away to the Teatvale Memorial itself, where we went through the same process. But this time there was a name to find. There was his name, thankfully. Often not the case, often these names are high up, but this one, W. Gattons, was at eye level. There's a wonderful photo that I have of Monica pointing to him whilst holding a photograph that she'd bought in the visitor centre, the Teatvale Memorial, with the poppies blowing in the wind. That was William's story. And our final story, on our way home, took us to the Loos battlefield, about an hour north of the Somme. And it concerns Lance Corporal Alfred Bradbury, who was serving in the 2nd Battalion of the Oxford and Bucks Light Infantry, when he died on the 25th of September 1915, the first day of the Battle of Loos, at the age of 32. And he was the son of Rose Bradbury from Cowley in Oxfordshire. His relative, Martin, not the same Martin as we talked about at Cumbria, another Martin, it was his relative. His medal index card tells us that as a territorial, he arrived on the Western Front on the 21st of September of 1914. Therefore, that means that he had taken part with his battalion at the Battle of Langemarck, the first Battle of Langemarck, not 1917, 1914, during that first Battle of Ypres. But after that, in December of 1914, the battalion was moved to the quiet area, I suppose, around Bethune. And they were in regular reliefs in and out the trenches until May of 1915, when they were involved in the Battle of Ober's Ridge and what was described as a gallant night attack in the Battle of Festubert on the 15th and 16th of May of 1915. But in the Battle of Loos, the brigade that they were part of made a subsidiary attack on that first day of the Battle of Loos, north of the canal that splits the battlefield. They did use gas. The idea was that they were to hold the enemy to their frontline trenches here and prevent them from moving reserves elsewhere. But it all went wrong. They suffered heavy losses without gaining any ground. I'd got an account of what happened that day, and I read it to Martin at the very point where his relative went over the top that day, the small village of Gavinci. So what happened on that day?
The British lines are where that tower...
Just running straight up?
Yeah, straight up in alignment with where we are now.
Yeah, yeah. Parallel to the road.
Parallel to this road, yeah. Yeah. The German line's literally 100 yards away. It's not far at all, and in between is no man's land. And it's cratered as well. You know, we're talking about there's loads of mine craters here. You know, they've been cratering under, been mining under each other for months. Not big craters like we saw yesterday.
Yeah.
Smaller craters.
Yeah.
So this is what we know. It's the 5th Brigade of the 2nd Division, is his battalion in. Consists of 4 regular and 2 territorial force battalions, and the Bucks is a territorial.
Yeah.
North of the La Boisselle Canal, which we just crossed.
Yep.
And ordered to take the German firing and support lines to the brigade's front, and then to consolidate the line
and advance about 1,000 yards. So they've got to go way beyond the German.
So that was the plan. Right.
And they were going to be helped by gas, of course. Gas was going to be released from cylinders and it would blow across no man's land and make their job a lot easier. And at 0 hour, the gas was released from the cylinders here and it spewed forth, the account says, but the wind had stopped. And even after the cylinders had been turned off, the gas hung about the British lines, with the troops having to wear their smoke helmets that they'd been given. The smoke, too, deepened in the wind and did not build up where intended, but it was the cloud of gas was seen by the Germans, who had ample time to light small fires on their parapet, put on their own gas masks, well before the small gusts of wind brought some of the gas in their direction.
So what would the fires do then? Burn the gas off?
I think so, yeah. Germans know how this gas worked. They'd used it a few months earlier up at Ypres.
Right.
But it's exactly the same type of gas, chlorine gas, which drowns you from within.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is where it... So it's going wrong for a start. They're choking and coughing in their own gas. And there was only 10 minutes of gas released rather than the 40 minutes. So not a lot of gas.
Yeah.
About 600 hours, the assaulting waves, the 2nd Oxfords and the 1st Queens and 2nd Highland Infantry left their trenches here and moved across no man's land towards the German firing line between 1 and 200 yards away.
Wow.
Despite a number of men in the attacking battalions having been affected by gas before putting their helmets on, the two left-hand battalions, the Queens and the HLI, managed to get into the German firing line without too much difficulty and took a number of prisoners. So they've done okay.
They've got in there.
But not
on
the
left-hand side, so that would be the sort of far...
far way.
Far, yeah.
But not the Ochsenbucks.
Right.
Whose left-hand company was heavily affected by a well-sighted and operated German machine gun. One machine gun. And they had to withdraw even before they got into the German firing line, by a more southerly route, using old craters in no man's land as cover. So they tried to get in using the craters.
Yeah.
Once in the German firing line, it was time to go to their support line, which is another 800 yards away. And it was at this point that things started to go wrong. So by hook or by crook, they've got into the German line. It's 150, 200 yards away over there. But then things go wrong. German snipers and machine gunners had recovered from their initial bombardment and began to cause casualties amongst the attackers. And the supply of bombs carried by the bombing party, these are hand grenades, carried by the bombing parties of each battalion, and began to run out. They're running out of bombs.
Right.
Not only were there not enough bombs, but many of this cricket ball, they look like cricket, not the pineapple shape, cricket ball with a fuse, which had to be ignited from a friction igniter carried by bombers before being thrown, would not ignite due to the damp weather.
Yeah.
They couldn't set them off. The troops did their best, but they could not secure a foothold in the German support line and were soon driven back to the firing line, still in the German lines. Even there, they couldn't hold it, and by 9:30, 3.5 hours after they set off, those who were alive and able to move were all back in their original trenches back here. The wind had let them down, 188 men had been killed, and there was neither smoke nor gas to cover them across open ground against objectives insufficiently damaged by artillery as have been made available north of the canal. They're using most of the artillery further south. This is a diversionary attack.
Yeah.
But they eventually discovered that 94 men died within that battalion. The figure that we just mentioned was within the brigade, but 94 within the battalion, 74 of them are still missing, including Alfred, who we know is on the memorial.
Yeah.
But in the guard cemetery at Windy Corner, which is appropriate for today, nearby, there are 3,445 burials, and over 2,000 of them are unknown. And there is one plot, two, where there are 16 men that died on that day. In amongst them, therefore, could be Alfred. Somewhere there, he could still be out there, couldn't he?
Very possibly.
He could still be out there.
Very possibly.
As with so many from that battle, Alfred has no known grave, and he's remembered on the Lewes Memorial, which was our final stop.
He's serving with his local regiment, the Oxford and Bucks.
Yeah.
And he's on, the panel numbers start there, and he's on 83 to 85.
Yeah, okay. All right, so we'll be down there somewhere. That's 100 and odd.
32 years old, he was the son of Mrs. Rose Bradbury from 80 Crescent Road in Cowley.
Yeah.
Age 32. In the 1911 census, I found him, and we've got his father, Stephen,
yep.
And his mum, Rose. He was then the oldest at 29 in 1911. And there's two others, Herbert and Kathleen.
Yep, I knew Kathleen.
Kathleen was only seven in 1911. Yep. Obviously, yep, Herbert and Kathleen were still at school, and Alfred was working as a general labourer.
Yep, that would be him.
At that time, in Cowley. Yeah. That was in 1911. He's one of the first to sign up. He's a volunteer, signs up. Oh, well, he arrived on the Western Front on the 21st of September 1914. So he must have been a territorial.
Yeah.
So he was trained.
Yeah.
But before that, in April of 1914, he appears in the press under the headline "Drunk." Alfred James Bradbury, 32 years old, from Crescent Road, a labourer, was charged with being drunk and
disorderly.
No.
Oh.
Incapable. In the Cowley Road, where he lived, on Saturday, 11:30 p.m. He's out. And the pubs have shut.
11:30.
That.
That's a good effort.
So staggering,
unless it's from the night before. Yeah.
The prisoner pleaded guilty, as charged, my lord, and was fined 1 shilling and 3 pence, and 1 shilling and 6 pence costs.
Six. Yeah.
Or, if he said he couldn't afford it, 7 days hard labour. We don't know which he chose.
Which he chose.
It doesn't say. So he's arrived on the Western Front in September 1914, which is not a great time to arrive on the Western Front in 1914.
No.
And he's involved in the Battle of Langemarck in October of 1914 up at Ypres. So that was no picnic. So he's seen plenty of action.
Yeah.
In May of 1915, there's the Battle of Aubers Ridge. They were in support during that battle, which was a disaster, as was the one a few weeks later at Festerberg. So he's seen some action before they get here. Yeah, nice to meet you, Alfred.
So now we've got the story of the cufflinks, which I mentioned earlier. And as we walked away from Alfred Bradbury's grave, I noticed that Bill had wandered off to look at two names on one of the panels nearby. There were the two captains in the Welsh regiment. One was a man called Charles Eyre, who it turns out was a friend of one of Bill's relatives that fought in the war. And just below him on the memorial to the missing was Fergus Bowes Lyon, who is a great uncle of King Charles III, the current British monarch. And Bowes Lyon had been killed during the Battle of Loos, September 1915, and for decades he was regarded as missing. That's why his name's on the memorial. But a few years ago, probably about 15 years ago, I think now, there was one grave in the Quarry Cemetery at nearby Vermel that it was proved beyond all doubt that that grave, that unknown grave, was in fact Captain Bowes Lyon. And therefore his details are now inscribed on that headstone. But it says buried near this spot because there's no actual certainty about the precise location of his remains within the cemetery. But as yet, his name has not been removed from the Loos Memorial to the Missing. So it was there that Bill explained the story of the cufflinks and the connection between Charles Eyre and Bowes Lyon. Bowes Lyon, although he's on the Memorial to the Missing, does now have a grave in the Quarry Cemetery. His body was identified, or his headstone, beneath an existing grave. They worked out who he was. So how have you got his cufflinks?
Right, my great uncle fought in the war. He got badly gassed, and he was in the same regiment as Charles Eyre, so he wasn't involved in the Battle of Loos.
Right.
So what happened was Charles Eyre was killed in the Battle of Loos. He was a bachelor. He was a very keen sportsman from Dundee. In fact, in Dundee now there is a big memorial to him, and I think you sent me the detail. He was leading his men. I think he went back to pick some men up. I think it was the information you gave me, and he got killed then. And he left his gold watch and his cufflinks to my great uncle.
Right.
We went out there around about 1973.
Yeah.
and my great uncle was in a nursing home, and he gave my younger brother, whose younger brother got the great big gold watch, which he still has, and he gave me.
You've got your cufflinks.
And I got the cufflinks, haven't I?
And do you wear them at all?
No.
No, they're there. So both were captains, Charles Eyre and Bowes Lyon are remembered right next to each other, alphabetical order, being officers on the panel for the, what was in the Welsh Regiment.
Yeah.
And that was it. That concluded our four-day battlefield tour. And we went up to Calais and made the usual journey back through Eurotunnel and safely back home with the memories that people will no doubt keep in their hearts and memories forever and pass on to their own family members. Maybe their own family members will make the same pilgrimage one day, following in the footsteps of the five soldiers. One of the things that occurred to me when I was listening to it back was when we were talking about Alfred Bradbury at the Lewes Memorial, and we told the story of Harry was fined for being drunk and incapable, we were laughing about that incident, and I wondered afterwards whether it was appropriate to laugh at a memorial to the missing. But then when I think back to the memoirs I've read, these men spent a lot of time together, enjoying each other's company out of the lines, and I'm sure they had many laughs as well, and I'm sure if they were listening, they'd have laughed at that story too. It's not all about sadness on the battlefields, and I think it's important that we reflect on that. So thank you very much again for tuning into the podcast. Please do rate and review wherever you download it from. It really does make a difference. And next week will be the anniversary of the successful Canadian attack on Vimy Ridge. So we've got a very special guest coming on next week to talk about that. I didn't want to tell a Canadian story myself, so I sought the help of someone called Samantha McRae, who does her own podcast, actually, and she's going to talk to us about the tremendous achievements of the four Canadian divisions that stormed Vimy Ridge on Easter Monday 1917. That's coming up next week. So it only remains for me to pay tribute to the five soldiers that we followed this week. Three of them didn't return home, and it's in their honour, well, in honour of all of them, really, that we end the podcast as usual, by the sounding of the last post.